Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
The enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and with me today is American comedian, commentator, actor, and all-around Beatle nut, John Fugelsang. And John, it's a pleasure to have you here. I've been on your show a couple of times. I'm just happy to get you here so we could talk a little bit about Beatles and the Bible.
Ah, right on. Okay. Things I like to geek out on. Thank you, Mr. Karam. What a pleasure.
So stick around. We've got to take a break and pay the bills, and we'll be right back. Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. With me is John Fugelsang. And John, I guess I'll start out asking you this. It's hard these days to separate politics from everything in life, but how do you look at the new administration with Joe Biden?
It's a good question. I'll always prefer a tourniquet to bleeding out on the sidewalk. So in that sense, I'm very grateful for this tourniquet of an administration. It was a very, you know, most people I've talked to, Joe Biden wasn't their first choice or their second or their third. I think maybe Biden's greatest achievement was getting so many liberals so excited to vote for him. But, 4,813 migrant children at the border were reunited with their families or placed into care awaiting their families to come back in the first 100 days.
Yeah.
He reversed, I think, 62 Trump orders in the first 100 days. It's a Democrat. So we know it's going to be a lot of broken hearts. We know it's going to be, a lot of dashed hopes. The Republicans are the champions of bad ideas, and the Democrats are the champions of saying, yes, terrible idea. Can we do that? So my thoughts are very complicated. I admire Joe Biden as a man more than I ever thought I would. But as you know, the Democratic Party is sort of like Clark Kent without a phone booth. They're sort of like an SNS who forgot their safe word and keeps getting beaten up. And when you see this kind of struggle go on, just to be able to have a majority vote, I mean, the filibuster struggle is just humiliating. Something that was never put in the Constitution, something the founders never planned on, something that was actually used
for racism
to shut John Quincy Adams up because he was complaining about slavery so much in the Congress. And that is the thing. That is the reason why every election we've ever been part of since we were in grade school, the majority wins. American Idol voting, the majority wins. Why is it that in the US Senate, that's not true? There, the filibuster is king. And it's what allows these Congress people to, these senators, to do nothing, to sit on their hands, to shirk responsibility, to not answer tough questions. And they don't even have to do a real filibuster. You just send an email saying, now, I'm going to have a filibuster.
I'm filibustering. It's not like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where you have to stand up until you pass out and filibuster.
Which Biden tried to do. Biden wanted to bring back the talking filibuster, which I would get behind. I think the American people deserve to see what their taxes are paying for, whether that's executions, whether that's Supreme Court deliberations, or whether it's a senator talking for 14 hours to make sure that we can't even have a vote. You know, like background checks after Newtown, 90% approval.
Right.
That's more popular than Christmas, but we weren't allowed to even have a vote on it because of this procedural gimmick that is supposed to stimulate debate, but it doesn't.
It shuts down debate.
It just creates more gridlock.
Well, you know, you talk about the Democrats and the Republicans in that sense. I've always said that one is a party of no heart and one is the party of no head. And I don't understand why we don't amend the filibuster rule. Maybe we'd be filibustered.
Privately funded elections, the square root of all of our problems, money and politics.
Yeah,
that's why. I mean, someday we'll know who was paying Kyrsten Sinema and who was paying Joe Manchin. You know, let me go out with them and guess insurance companies and coal industry, maybe, to block this thing and keep this anti-democratic relic going. But people are suffering right now. And you'll notice they have no problem using the filibuster to confirm judges.
Yes.
But when it comes to actually fixing our crumbling bridges and airports and railways, then they use it to block anything. So what are we going to leave our grandkids here? Federal judges with crumbling roads, bridges, and infrastructure?
A third world nation run by lunatics is what.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, one of the most fascinating things over the last 40 years of politics, and I really do blame Ronald Reagan for a lot of this. I mean, he started it, and it was and the roots of it were Nixon's Southern strategy to win. But Reagan really doubled down and created the kind of state that we have today, the divisiveness. And I look back at some of the things that we have not accomplished. And if you look at 40 years ago, when you had transatlantic flight on the Concorde, you had the highest, our rail system was in much better shape. Our highway system was just being finished. Today, it's all crumbling. I go overseas, and there are many countries that have much better service and much better infrastructure than the U.S. We're teetering on a third world, it's dystopian to me.
Yeah, and they're laughing at us. Our allies laugh at our decrepit airports and railways and crumbling bridges. And again, it's deliberate. It's by design. It's not an accident. Someone decided it should be this way. And this is...
To what end is it just for money in the pocket?
Yeah. We were founded by slave owners who wanted to be free. And
that should go on a t-shirt somewhere, actually.
Well, I mean, George Carlin said it better, but they also felt that they should be the only ones to vote, white landowning males.
Right.
And since the founders, every advancement in voting rights has never been given. It has been fought for. For anyone beyond a rich white male to vote, that's been a struggle, and it still is to this day. We are a country that is drunk on our own propaganda, and it's what keeps us from being decent.
That brings me to politics and the Bible. It keeps us from being decent. Yet, however, when I go out into the hinterlands or outside of D.C., and talk to people, they're convinced that we're a God-fearing nation and vested in Jesus Christ. And I can't find anything in Christ's teachings that in any way supports the Republican agenda.
There's not. There is not at all. They say Jesus is their savior. He's actually their mascot, and he might just be their prop. They say they want a government based on Christian values, and I say, sign me up. Because, I vote for Jesus, Brian. You should know this. Every year I do a write-in. I do a write-in for Jesus because I think, why not? Think about the most hardcore right-wing conservative people in your life. Wouldn't they love to cut out the middleman and just vote for Jesus of Nazareth? Wouldn't your fundamentalist Christian loved ones, or that guy on Facebook, whomever, wouldn't they love to vote for Jesus, a peaceful, radical, nonviolent revolutionary who hung around with lepers, hookers, and crooks, who never spoke English, was not an American citizen, was anti-capitalism, anti-wealth, anti-death penalty, anti-public prayer. Yes, he was. Matthew 6:5, yes, anti-public prayer.
Yes.
Never anti-gay.
Pray in private.
Never mentioned abortion. never technically came out against premarital sex, never called the poor lazy, never said torture's okay sometimes, never fought for tax cuts for the wealthiest Nazarenes, and was a long-haired, brown-skinned, that's in Revelation, brown-skinned, homeless, community organizing, unarmed, anti-slut-shaming, liberal Palestinian Jew. But that's only if you believe what's actually in the Bible.
And
my favorite thing to do is to thump Bible thumpers with the Bible, because usually they've never read it. And it goes to show that some of the most wonderful Christians I've ever known are atheists, and some of the most godless heathens I've ever known are believers.
That is in the Bible too, about the Antichrist. That, I mean, if you've read the Bible, it warns against those who preach it but don't know it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And you know, liberals say Trump's the Antichrist. No, Trump is not the Antichrist, but Christ is the anti-Trump.
Yeah. Trump is just people thought of him as a cause. I always look at him as a symptom. I don't think he was, yeah. We created Trump. We made him possible. And one of the things I've noticed,
I actually think he's a quack treatment you take for a symptom instead of addressing the actual cause,
which causes additional pain. it's like getting drunk to cure being high. but one of the byproducts of politics today and Trump and the GOP is that, I'm going to reflect back on something that Eric Swalwell told me on this show a couple of weeks ago when I was interviewing him. He said he walked into a bathroom one day during the impeachment hearings and Ted Cruz said, "Hey, you're really doing great out there. Keep it up." And he realized at that point in time that the GOP didn't treat their constituents as constituents. They treated them as fans. So yeah, they go out and they say what they think their fans want to hear.
Always.
And not necessarily what they need to hear.
Always.
Yeah. And that to me is the problem in politics today. And boy, there's a biblical reflection in that and what Jesus taught. But it's the idea that you go out and tell your constituents exactly what they want to hear in order to get their vote.
That's all it is. And they're not even fans. They are children to be placated to the GOP. Just you know, tell them the right words and they'll go back to bed or watch their show. And they don't, they're not a party of public service. You know, I ask them all the time, because I love talking to conservative folk, and I always ask them, what is something the Republican Party has done for non-millionaires? I don't mean a tax cut for rich people where a little trickles down the year. Right. I mean, what's something they've done just for non-millionaires since Nixon and the earned income tax credit? I mean, you could maybe say the Americans with Disabilities Act, but that was bipartisan. Bush just signed.
That was a bipartisan, yeah.
Yeah, so I always say, what have Republicans done for non-millionaires? You know, and folks have never thought about it, because you get a lot farther just telling people what they want to hear. And that's very seductive to people. Every president we've ever had has always appealed to the better angels of our nature, right? Even Bush, who I still think history may record as being a worse president than Trump, because
the second Bush,
the second Bush, yes,
the first Bush is right there too, but
Bush was just a bad, listen, the worst thing Trump did was make W look good, and the worst thing W did was make his father look like Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
But like every one of them, you know, talks about how good we can be, you know, what we can do if we work together, how good we can, how much good is ahead of us if we can just tap into the goodness in ourselves. Trump was the first guy to come along and say, hey, folks, look at me. I'm a big racist millionaire at birth asshole, and I'm rich. Look how awesome I am banging models and getting away with it. And I'll tell you who to blame, poor brown people at the border. That's really seductive. Telling people you're okay just the way you are. I mean, yeah, that's the essence of maybe a loving boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. But in terms of a civic society, it's very seductive. And that's all he was. Trump supporters were the tragic girl at a frat party being lied to by the brutish, drunken trust fund brat.
Yeah, and I've always said Matt Gaetz was the guy who belongs to the frat who bought his date to the party, and they all stole his date from him.
You know, I've always said Matt Gaetz is the guy that your roommate invites to the dorm room party, and then he stands over there in the corner, like, screaming really loud, "Healthcare is a privilege, not a right!" And by the end of the party, he's the last one there crying because no one likes him and he can't get a date, and you realize you hate your roommate for inviting this dude. That's Matt Gaetz.
He gets a date with a girl that nobody wanted. What's her name?
Yeah, Matt Gaetz is—he's hit bottom so many times. He's fracking. He's legally fracking. He's hit rock bottom so hard. I mean, Matt Gaetz is so juvenile. He sent a Venmo to himself.
Matt Gaetz is so juvenile. He ended up with Marjorie Taylor Greene running away from their own press conference. But
man, Lady Blah Blah. Let's talk about that. You know, when God closes a Donald Trump comedy door, he opens a Marjorie Taylor Greene comedy window.
You know, what's funny about that is you joke about that, but everything that you've just said does remind me a little bit of what George Carlin said. They just want you smart enough to operate the machinery.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. They don't want critical thinkers. They don't want an informed civic society. They want consumers. And you know, they don't want you to realize how badly you've been getting screwed by their agenda for years and years, but they also know they're losing. The Republican Party has, and again, I'm not a Democrat. Full disclosure, I've never been a Democrat. I've never belonged to a political party, but.
Full disclosure, I'm a reporter and I give shit to everybody. That's the way it should be.
You have to. I'm a comedian. You have to.
Well, there you go. That's the other thing. It pisses me off when people go, well, you're left, or you're just, because I disagree with what you say doesn't mean I absolutely agree with what they say.
Oh, you're a leftist now if you can spell the word "you're" correctly. I mean, you're a leftist now if you accept science, you know?
Yeah.
It makes you
think we're in the Middle Ages again. It's like medieval times with technology.
But it's always been that way. Fascism always demonizes smart people. Every culture. I mean, the Khmer Rouge would kill you if you wore glasses because they thought it meant you were educated. So it's like, you know, Dan Quayle did this. I mean, the academic elite, intellectual elite. I'm like, don't you want the smartest people in charge of things? No. And people said they like George Bush because, you know, he's like one of us. I'm like, one of you. So it's just tribalism. It's not about having a successful society.
Well, that goes back to what you said about Christianity. Teaching that we are the world, we're together, we're all one, is not part of the GOP.
Not at all. I mean, not only does God endorse multiculturalism, I'm pretty sure God created multiculturalism. But, you know, that speaks to the immigration business. Like, there is nothing that makes a Christian angrier than to remind them that there are no laws in the Bible about borders or immigration. I'm pretty sure if there is a God, he or she doesn't really give a damn about the invisible lines we've created in the ground to separate our tribes.
Yes.
Pretty sure God doesn't have anything invested in the borders we made up that you can't see from heaven. And yet, you know, swarthy brown people are to be abused. And the guys who outsourced your job to China are on TV telling you to blame those brown men outside Home Depot trying to get day labor work for your job being outsourced to China.
Well,
you know, and that's the border racism works beautifully. Donald Trump is a guy who's hired undocumented immigrants going back to the 80s.
And refused to pay them too, but
and he still hires them now. Donald Trump outsourced his manufacturing to Mexico and China, but he ran on bringing back our jobs. And you know, it just, you tell them the opposite and they'll believe it, and you play to their prejudices. And Donald Trump showed how easy it is for a dumb guy who's famous enough to do this.
Yeah, there's the other Carlin saying, think about how stupid the average American is and realize that more than half of them are dumber than that.
Right? Like illegal immigration. I don't trust either political party on this issue because you want to end undocumented workers. It's really simple. You start locking up the white people who do the hiring.
Yeah.
Right? There's no wall you can build, Brian, that's large enough to hide the gigantic help wanted sign at our border. You don't need to build a wall. You need to take down the help wanted sign. But they won't do it because exploiting marginalized labor, primarily of brown people, has literally been the way this country's operated its economy since slavery.
Well, you take a look. There's Smiley Butler, I believe, is
former
Stanley Butler, War is a Racket.
War is a Racket. And you go back to that. This is when I laugh. This is one of the things that angered me about the current administration is they're putting together a select group to decide to try and look at the root causes of the problems of immigration. It's as simple as our foreign policy and the fact that our businesses created the entire environment.
Yeah.
Even down to the illegal drug trade. There's an illegal drug trade and a lot of money south of the border because there's a demand for the drugs in the United States.
That's it. I mean, these Central American refugees, they're fleeing the violence of our drug war.
Yeah.
I was down, by the way, I got news for you.
The drugs won the drug war.
I was down doing stand-up in El Salvador and Honduras a couple years back for the troops. We have military bases in El Salvador and Honduras. Indeed, we do, for the drug war. And in Honduras, the U.S. Air Force base was made of wood. It was temporary. And most of the buildings were made of wood. And now, decades later, the base was being eaten by termites. If you looked into one of the lights, into the dish over the light, you would see the bodies of dead termites all over the place. And I thought, there's a metaphor I can get high on. We're still down there fighting the Reagan's drug war. And Reagan, ironically, was maybe the last president to tell the truth about immigration. Reagan stood for open borders. His words, he said they should be able to come here and work and then go home. Reagan used the word amnesty proudly and gave them all citizenship. And boy, man, it's not the Ebola, it's the amnesia that's the greatest airborne virus in this country.
Well,
you don't remember.
Willful ignorance. Willful ignorance. I mean, just being unable to come to grips with our own past on so many levels.
That's why I find your job fascinating, because it's not just the politicians who have to play dumb to placate the audience that they believe their audience to be, but the journalists do it too. And I mean, sitting in a room with Peter Doocy and like watching how these half-wits have to pretend to be quarter-wits to appease their audience. I mean, it's maddening to me, but I can only imagine what it's like for you in the room.
It's frustrating for me on a number of levels, because there are some that are not willfully ignorant in the press. They are dangerously and authentically ignorant.
Yeah.
And I mean, there are people in that press room that don't, I had someone come up to me and I said, well, look, this is how it was done when I got here, and Helen and Sam, you know, this is how Mark, and they go, who's Helen? You know, who's
Sam? Of course.
And if you don't know the history, hell, they don't even know who the Brady briefing room is named for. And
of course,
that to me is frightening on a whole different level.
Oh yeah.
And they will look down at, you know, they think they know everything and they know nothing. And
yeah, well, that's Dunning-Kruger effect. And you know, the more ignorant they are, the more they don't know that they're ignorant. And
yes.
I mean, you know, all the religions tell us the wise person is the one who realizes that he or she is not wise. But you know, this still sells, this smug certainty, right? This
oh yeah.
Well, this Antichrist certainty, that, you know, that's the essence of fundamentalism. I mean, that's religious fundamentalism, is that like, it doesn't matter if I don't know the facts because I'm on the side of the one true God. And if you're
Jesus trusts me and I trust Jesus, and that's the way it is.
Or Allah, if you
or
will.
Or Allah, like, yeah.
Like all the religious fundamentalists, they have the same things in common, I find, from my tussles with all of them. It doesn't even matter the religion. You can be fundamentalist Jewish, Hindu, Christian. They believe that women are second-class citizens. The more conservative your religion is,
yes,
the more, you know, the weaker sex. Being gay is a sin. The more conservative your religion, doesn't matter which one. Sex in general is icky.
Yeah.
Unless
they're doing it with somebody they shouldn't, in places they shouldn't, underneath covers where, you know, no one can see.
Oh, but that's not what they preach. What they preach is what I'm talking about.
But you know, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Finish. Oh, violence is okay if my side does it. Again, the more conservative your religion is, doesn't matter the religion. And other religions are okay, but I know I have the
mine
one
is the right
one. And then there's also a penchant for victimhood all the time. But that's like its own religion, fundamentalism. You know, I have this fight with Bill Maher all the time because he's, you know, says religion's responsible for all the war and oppression of women. And I'm like, no, it's not religion. The overwhelming majority of moderate and liberal Christians, Jews, and Muslims are getting along just fine right now. They don't get the clicks. It is those hopeless romantics, the far extreme right assholes of all the religions that make life so interesting for the rest of us. So and I would see it in practice in our country every day. I'm on the side of God, so it doesn't matter that I haven't actually read his book.
Or I know what God stands for. I just say that that's the Six Flags over Jesus mentality.
And that way it's so simple because if anyone opposes you, they're on the side of Satan. I'm not going to sit down and negotiate school curriculum or what goes in a textbook or what marriage is with an agent of Satan. And that's why it's so dangerous. And that's why I prefer to, you know, use the Bible. I grew up watching TV and you would see the atheist or the people screaming at women outside clinics. And those were the two positions you were offered, right-wing Jerry Falwell or non-believer. And boy, man, the death threats I get from these believers, because I've read their book and they haven't.
Most of my death threats have come from people who say they are serious Christians and that I deserve to die because I'm not.
The calls I get from people who think that women who terminate pregnancies should get the death penalty. I mean, Brian, pro-lifers will freaking kill us.
Yeah, there you go. And on that wonderful thought, let's take a break and we'll be right back.
Hey there, JATQ listeners. We deeply appreciate your listenership and the audience we've been able to cultivate while producing this podcast. Thanks to all of your support, we've been able to ramp things up and create even more content for you to enjoy. Through our Patreon page, there are lots of new and exciting things to check out. Due to the way Patreon is set up, it's entirely up to you, the listener, to decide what that content is worth. The podcast episodes will always be free, but if you want to gain access to our weekly newsletter, ad-free episodes, exclusive merch, and much, much more, you'll want to head over to patreon.com/JATQ podcast. That's patreon.com/JATQ podcast. Thanks. Have a great day.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. And with us is Father John Fugelsang, who's...
my God.
You know, there was a funny, I'm sure you've probably heard it, but there's a funny anecdote attributed to John Kennedy, the first, you know, John F. Kennedy, our first Catholic president. And one day his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, said, look, there's a contingency of bishops and nuns here to see you. And he said, make the bishops wait. They all vote Republican anyway.
He was right. I come from a weird Christian background. My father was a Franciscan brother who wore the rope belt and the robes and walked amongst the people like the lost Jedi of Flatbush. And my mom was a nun from the segregated South. And she joined the convent after high school. They put her into nursing school and then sent her off to work first with lepers and then in a jungle hospital in Malawi, Africa. So wow. I grew up around a lot of clergy and a lot of ex-clergy. And, you know, some of the best people I know, I've ever known, have been religious. And some of the most twisted, dark, lost souls I've ever known has been that way as well.
That's true. And, that you know, I remember here's my one priest story from being an altar boy. When we were young, there was a Irish priest, good Irish priest, and if you were an altar boy on Sunday, you wanted his noon mass because he got out of there quick because it was a sports day and he wanted to watch basketball, Louisville basketball or Kentucky basketball or football. So his homilies were notoriously short. And one day he walked in and he says, "Hi, as we saw in the gospel today, Jesus is a fine lad and so were all the saints. Now on with it." And you're going, as an altar boy, you're going, bet I'm out of here. And so at the end of the day, mass is done. We're cleaning up and in walks, and I'll never forget Bobby Jones, and he goes, "Father, you got to talk to you're not taking care of your flock. This was horrible. You were in here and you're out of here." And he goes, "Hey, Bobby Jones, what is it you do for a living, lad?" He goes, "Well, you know, I'm a tax attorney." "Aye, I do. And you live on that big house down the street, don't you?" He goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "And how many children have you?" He goes, well, you know, I have six kids because, you know, you were there. I and you're married, you make good money. And he goes, well, yeah. He says, well, I'll tell you what, Bobby, my lad. He says, I've given up wine, women, and song for me, Faith. What have you given up? You keep your pecker in your pants and let me worry about the flock. And I started laughing, right? And the guy left. And the father looked at me. He says, boyo, he says, you can be absolutely right about a ting at the absolute wrong time. And I go, yeah, whatever. And then the next day, I'm taking piano lessons from Sister Mary Elizabeth, who's frustrated beyond belief for a variety of reasons. And I can't keep time with a metronome. No matter how hard I try, I can't do it. And she wrapped me across the wrist with a ruler. And I said, God damn it, this is why they ought to let you people get laid. And so I think her slap started in Florida, gained in, you know, acceleration through the Carolinas. And by the time it hit me across the mouth, man, I was done. And I heard this laughing and the nun went out. A few minutes later, the priest, same priest as the day before, stuck his head back in. He says, boyo, remember what I told you, you can be absolutely right about a ting at the absolute wrong time. And I was like, got it. And that was one of the things I learned was, you know, discretion. But the worst thing you ever saw in those masses was where they were teaching brotherly love and then they go out in the parking lot to leave and beat the shit out of each other trying to get out of the parking lot first.
Or the worst thing I ever saw in the masses is how children are trained to discuss how unworthy they are. You know, I mean, I confess to you, Almighty God, and to you, my brothers and sisters, that I have sinned through my own faults. In my thoughts, I have sinned. In my words, I have sinned. And what I have done and what I have failed to do. I mean, I am not worthy to receive you. You know, it's just this.
Say the word and I shall be healed.
Yeah, it's this systemic programming of your own unworthiness. And that's how you control the population. And that'll keep people in line for a couple of millennia until electricity and TV come along. But it's one of the reasons why, you know, religion is on the wane. People say that the largest growing demographic religiously in this country are Mormons. I think the largest growing demographic are people who were raised religious and now consider themselves spiritual because they're turned off to the hypocrisies of organized religion. And that's okay. As long as people are nice, you know, I kind of feel as long as you're operating from a place of love and compassion and forgiveness and empathy, great. I've seen as much evidence that religion teaches you to be unkind as I have that it teaches you to be kind. And, you know, that duality is in all of us. So I think religion can have a revival, but it's only going to come back if it actually reflects the teachings of Jesus more and not the hangups of dead guys and not this homophobia, which is not supported by scripture or anti-birth control or anti-masturbation or, you know, all this other stuff that doesn't exist in the Bible. So it's like, and I get in a lot of trouble, but when I my mom never let me talk about my past or my parents' past. And then I moved to LA to work on a TV show and I was doing Bill Maher a lot. And they would have and they wound up having me on to debate Jerry Falwell and having me on to debate David Duke. And finally, my mom gave me permission to talk about my past and it opened up a big floodgate of like, you know, OK, how can I do this as a comic? How can I talk about religion and hypocrisy and fundamentalism, have enough dick jokes to make it entertaining for the flock. And
wait a minute, dick jokes with priests or without priests?
Oh, you know, and whatever. I don't discriminate.
You know, I never
you get farther with love and the truth than a dick joke than just love and the truth. I'll tell you that.
I had a date like that once. No one, I'm going there. Well, look, while we're here, I have to do this. I'm going to shift gears because you and I have something in common that we have to talk about. And that is musically the Beatles and a love for the Beatles. And I want to start with you've met three of them. Correct?
Yes.
Tell me about you've met them all but John then, I take it. Or did you meet John?
Yeah, I know. No, I was only a kid when John, I wasn't born until after they broke up. And, you know, although John is the only one who follows me on Twitter, which is a bit odd.
He follows me on Twitter too.
Frank Zappa followed me on Twitter yesterday. I'm like, I think you've been gone for 25 years, but that's pretty hip, Zap. You know,
the mothers of invention are a little slow.
I came to it late, but you know, I don't know why. It had been, as a teenager in the 80s, that was the music that spoke to me, and I'm one of those guys who like thinks, you know, you can't be a real Beatle fan unless you understand that the solo careers are also part of the fandom.
Yes.
I actually think the Beatles invented the concept of a solo career. And I mean, maybe Diana Ross, but you know, for me, it was very, very spiritual. I think a lot of us can learn a lot about humanity by studying these four young men and their personalities and their love. All of them made, all of them, including Mr. Starkey, made really good music. All of them made bad music. All of them have done great things. All of them have screwed up in public in all too public ways. So my first broadcasting job was for VH1. They hired me to be the comic, but I wound up being the classic rock nerd.
Wow.
And so George was my favorite. George was someone who, the first solo album I got into was Cloud Nine. Again, I was young, I was late to this, but 87, Got My Mind Set on You was unescapable from the radio. Yeah. And it was a superb, perfect pop song. Jeff Lynne is just, when Jeff Lynne gets it right, he gets it so right.
Traveling Wilburys.
Yeah, yeah. And all those Tom Petty albums. Jeff Lynne wrote I Won't Back Down with Tom Petty.
Yeah.
Which
was a song that was popular when I went to jail for the First Amendment. So I've always had an affinity for that song. But go ahead.
That's my favorite Tom Petty album too.
Yeah.
And Jeff Lynne produced Tom Petty's last solo album, the Highway Companion, which is really underrated. And so McCartney picked me to interview him at a special in London at Bishopsgate, a live town hall we were doing. And so I was getting ready to go. And I'll never forget, I was buying like McCartney records at Sam Goody when that was a thing. And I got a call saying, we need you to go to London a day later. I'm like, oh no, I've never been before. I was young and I was like, why have I got to stay here? They said, we need you to stay an extra day in New York for George Harrison and Ravi Shankar. Now, George Harrison was the Beatle who first got me into it. You know, like Cloud Nine was as big to me as Sgt. Pepper as a kid. I think I got into Cloud Nine before I got into Sgt. Pepper. That was one of my gateway drugs into being a Beatle fanatic. And a lot of the songs on Cloud Nine are really
Beatles.
Yeah, and George is talking about God. Fish on the Sand is not about love for a woman. It's about God. A lot of those songs are. Same with Dylan, by the way, but that's another matter. I could talk about Bob Dylan. I've seen Bob Dylan live enough times to end a marriage. I think I'm 61 Dylan shows. But So George had the album Chance of India. He produced for Ravi Shankar. And I had loved him because he was raised Catholic. And as he got further away from the church, his spirituality deepened. And I always really related to that and found it very powerful.
Yeah.
My father too, you know, my dad always said that when he left the religious and married my mom, that was a continuation of his faith. That was just as he was called to be a celibate Franciscan, he felt the same calling him to leave that and marry my mom. And that meant a lot to me. I think love for my mom was my dad's true religion. So George came in with Ravi Shankar. They were gonna just do a 10-minute soundbite and then leave. And I was the biggest George Harrison fanatic that ever lived. I'm sure I'm the biggest George Harrison geek that ever interviewed him. And I was the worst interviewer of all time. I could not shut up. I was making jokes about Rick Astley and the Spice Girls. I was, you know, my mission was that I was going to bully George Harrison on camera into doing another tour because he hadn't toured since the 70s. And I was going to just shame him into touring again or putting out another album. It had been 10 years. And I guess he liked the rawness of it because he stayed for 4 hours.
Wow.
And then one of the crew members' girlfriend had come by to visit with her guitar and we put it in his hands and he wound up playing four songs. He hadn't done a concert in America since the 70s, and this was the late 90s, but he did All Things Must Pass. He did a Wilbury song that Dylan had sung. He sang an Indian Vedic chant, Prabhuji, with Ravi Shankar on the sitar, and he did an unreleased tune. But when we began this, it was just me and George and Ravi on a set. By the time we ended, there was like hundreds of people in the room. Rick Rubin was there, the editor of Billboard was there.
Wow.
It was really, really a magical time. And he left and gave me the most beautiful smile and hug I'd ever had. He was so funny. You know, when he arrived, I left the makeup room and I went into the green room to greet him. And he just jumped to his feet and said, you must be the one wearing the makeup then. And he was diagnosed.
George.
Right. I worked on my George impression a lot when I was younger. If that's not your grandfather, I've seen your grandfather. He lives in your house. They made it like a 30-minute special, and nobody watched it. And then he got diagnosed with cancer two months later.
Well, here's all right.
It wound up being his last public performance. And after, when he got sick, they recut it to be an hour-long special. The day he died, they aired it around the clock. Now, I was so ashamed I'd met my idol and been terrible. But when they aired it around the clock, I was able to forgive myself and be like, oh, I was just a kid who was so excited. And to this day, Brian, I'll have like straight guys come up to me at airports and hug me and say, that was the most spiritual thing I ever saw on TV. Because we talked about God and what happens when you die and the soul, and they cut all that shit out on VH1. But when he died, they put all that back in the special. At one point, George even said, this is a bit lofty for VH1. But I'm always going to be grateful that I had no game, that I was so bad at my job.
Well, that's when you're at your best, when you're curious. I find, to me, as an interviewer, you can go in with a couple of set of ideas, but honestly, it's when you are engrossed in the material and are curious. It's a curious mind that makes the best interviewer. And even right. if you're a fan, you're curious in that manner, and you can bring out the best in people, or in some cases, the worst. Right. So I've got to ask you, if you're a George fan, what's your favorite George song with the Beatles, and what's your favorite solo song?
That's rough. You know, there's the obvious ones. I guess I'll say It's All Too Much, because
no fucking one... A right, baby. That's the oh yes. That's it. If you're a Beatle fan and you all right. Respect, my brother, because
no one's ever going to say it, but I think because It's All Too Much is the most underrated Beatles song.
I think it is too.
If they had released that song 5 months earlier and put it on Sgt. Pepper's instead of the Yellow Submarine soundtrack,
yes,
it would be considered a classic today. But as it is, unless you own the Yellow Submarine album, you've probably never heard it. And there's
another song on that album I'll go with as well, and that's Hey Bulldog. But I think Dave Grohl made it more popular, and there have been a couple of artists that have done it. But those two songs on the Yellow Submarine album, I always thought, with Off the White album, everybody's got something to hide except for me and my monkey.
Isn't that great? That's like the greatest Rolling Stones song the Beatles did.
Yeah.
George's playing is like Keith Richards on
Yes. You know, but it's so all that matches. Yeah. All right. Go ahead.
That's my most underrated one. And then my favorite George solo song or album?
Solo song.
Oh, wow. Oh, Lord. I don't know. That's hard.
That's a hard one, isn't it?
I guess All Things Must Pass. I don't know. But I think the album George Harrison is his most
Master underrated. Of Going Faster.
Yeah. It's just the eponymous album, George Harrison from the late 70s. Some would call it yacht rock. Some would call it light rock. But it's such a beautiful melodic record that
I love that record.
Heard, and it's really underrated.
That's that may be my favorite George Harrison solo album. And there's
really, All Things Must Pass.
Well, okay, underrated. All Things Must Pass. Yeah, but I mean, but I like you said, it was an overlooked gem to me.
Oh yeah,
that album.
Yeah, good stuff. But I love McCartney stuff. I love McCartney solo stuff. Most of it. I thought the Egypt Station album was great, you know, and it's great now they're releasing all this stuff. The new Plastic Ono Band box set they put out, it sounds incredible. It sounds like it doesn't sound like a Phil Spector record anymore. It sounds like a rock band in a room, and all the instruments are it's been completely reproduced, and it sounds like there's a band in the room with you. I'm so excited for the new George box set, for the All Things Must Pass box set coming out.
I'll get it. Yeah. I have every cutout. Let's see, somewhere in here, somewhere in all my collection in the back there, I have probably 40 hours of unreleased Beatle stuff. There was a friend of mine who was an editor on the John Lennon Yoko Ono movie, and Yoko walked in one day and just dumped a box of tapes and said, here, you can use this.
Wow.
And so he copied it all for himself, and then gave me a cut, because he was an editor of ours at America's Most Wanted. He ended up making copies available for Beatles fans, and
right on.
Actually how he and I bonded. Nobody wanted, he was just a gripey old editor and complained constantly, and nobody wanted to be with him. And so one day I'm sitting in there editing with him in the booth, and I noticed he had a Beatle pin, and I said, "Oh, you're a Beatle fan." He goes, "Yeah, what about it?" And I said, "Well, you know, I am too." And we started talking, and after that, we worked pretty well together. But
I love that stuff. I spent my 20s buying all these bootleg cassettes and CDs, and now they're all being released finally.
It's incredible. I know.
Released the Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Woodstock sessions as an album this year. Like, it's finally come out, and it's great.
The thing that you have, well, there's a couple of things that I really like. I have John Lennon and Jimi Hendrix on stage playing Day Tripper in London, which is a good, if you haven't heard it, it's a great, great one. And then there's a real lengthy version of, I think it's a 43-minute version of Helter Skelter.
Yeah.
And that is interesting on many
levels. Oh, yeah. I love all that stuff. I love the George Harrison, Paul Simon collaborations on SNL.
Yes.
That's
a
great one. That's never been released. There's and then just the unreleased bootleg stuff as well that's out there. There's so much music they made and are still making. You know, if you haven't seen Paul McCartney live, my friends, if he ever does another tour.
Oh, he's great. I mean, live.
You gotta go. I'm still hoping that Paul will be my son's first concert.
There were two bonding moments with me and my kids. One was going to a Who concert together. I was sitting in the seats, and this is in DC, and the effervescent aroma of marijuana was everywhere. And my son, he was 10. He goes, "Dad, what's that?" I go, "Well, that's weed." He goes, "How do you know?" "I've been smoking it since the 70s, son. Trust me, that's weed." So we were in a Who concert with weed, and then seeing Paul McCartney live was great.
Yeah.
And those were, but I've, you know, you got it on me. I've never met any of them. What was it like meeting Ringo? I met Pete Best. That was,
That's pretty hip. I never met Pete Best.
Yeah.
I met Yoko, and both of John's sons have done my show. And I met Donnie Harrison and Mary. I've met Paul, two of Paul's kids. Mary did my show recently. And I worked with Paul a few times, but with Ringo, it was funny because I didn't actually meet him per se. He came to do a top 10 countdown at VH1. He was hosting, and I came in that day because I brought my Ringo Starr tour program from his very first ever tour with the All Stars in 1989, which was an amazing band. Lee Von Helm and Rick Danko,
yes.
Dr. John, Billy Preston, Clarence Clemens, Joe Walsh, Nils Lofgren. What a band. And this guy named Mitch was the producer. And I kept saying to Mitch, all I want is to get him to sign my program. Will you please? So Ringo was there, he was doing his thing. I didn't get to meet him. At one point I handed him a glass of water and he went, "Thanks." So that was it.
You do good, Ringo.
I was talking to his managers the whole time. I'm like, why won't he do Don't Pass Me By in Octopus's Garden live? Why won't he do the live? And they said, he tried it didn't work. I'm like, you make him try it again. Yeah. But all I wanted was my program signed. It was raining. I went to the Hell's Kitchen in the rain. Our studio is where the Daily Show is now. And Mitch, who was a friend of mine, the producer, said, "Okay, give me the program. I'll give it to his people. We'll get him to sign it, okay? But you can't do it. We'll get his people to sign it." So I gave him my program. I waited. And then eventually they said he'd left. And I'm like, "Mitch, where's my program?" And it turned out he left with it. My Beatle memorabilia got swiped by a Beatle
star.
And I was like, I want it back.
Yeah,
I want it back, and I would like it signed, please. And Mitch was like, "Don't make me do that." I'm like, "Mitch, you didn't have to take it, but he took it. Mitch, make a phone call, make the call." And I made this guy's life hell. I'm like, "Give him my program back." And so finally, a couple of weeks later, we get the program back. They sent it back and I opened it up and Ringo had signed it to Mitch. Love Ringo. And it's worth even more to me now for that reason.
What was the first Beatle album you bought?
Magical Mystery Tour.
Mine too. Magical Mystery Tour and the White Album. Confession.
An unwatchable film, but so many great songs on one.
Oh, Magical Mystery.
Yeah. It's
an unwatchable film until you've tripped. And then it has a completely different perspective.
Maybe. I kind of feel like that's a movie to scare kids off hallucinogens.
Well, you know what movie? There's a recent movie, which one was it, with that Bono was in, the movie with all the Beatles songs in it.
Oh, yeah. Across the Universe.
Across the Universe. Stole
it. Like 12 years old, but yeah, it's kind of recent, yeah.
Yeah, recent. But they stole a scene from Magical Mystery Tour.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Remember at Magical Mystery Tour when they all the Beatles and everybody emerges out, they emerge from the tent?
Yeah.
Well, that's in, you know.
You're right. It's an homage. Yeah. I like that movie. I love Julie
Taymor. Oh, I love that movie.
I love Julie Taymor. I'll see anything she does.
There was a great line, or they asked Paul McCartney if he liked it and Yoko, and both of them said, "What's not to like?"
Yeah.
By the way,
I went and saw Yoko a couple of years ago with the Plastic Ono Band in Times Square in Central Park. And I took my assistant and I kept explaining to her, now this is really avant-garde. This is not going to make any sense. It's going to be really weird. Be ready. And the show was so great. And it made me realize what was avant-garde in 1965 is just artsy rock now. I mean, Bjork exists because of Yoko. And it was actually a terrific show.
Remember what John Lennon said when he first heard the B-52s. He said, "Mother, they're doing you."
And
you know, with all the yips and the yells and everything, that was all Yoko.
Yeah, really true.
And you're right. What was avant-garde then is just passé now, I guess.
At least artsy rock now, you know?
What was funny is the woman who owned the newspaper I worked for and ran, I ran a newspaper group for a number of years, a couple of community newspapers. She was Yoko Ono's college roommate.
Wow.
And I had known her for 5 or 6 years before she dropped that knowledge on me one day. I go, "What? Who is your roommate?" And she said, "Well, it was this little art student. She was just an art student, and she was gonna bring her boyfriend over to the house." And I go, "Wait a minute, what? Stop!" And it was Yoko, and her.
She's my neighbor now. I live 3 blocks away from her.
Well, a buddy of mine, when I was at America's Most Wanted, had a at Lafayette and Prince Street, had a loft, and her art studio was underneath his, loft, and I met her. I ran into her one day, didn't recognize her at first. I was going up to my buddy's Peter's house, and I, you know, opened up the door, and there she was. I said, "Excuse me, ma'am," and then I heard her voice, and I go, "You're Yoko."
That's, oh, wow. How neat.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. And I came to the Beatles, you know, I'll tell you this, the night John died, I was in college and I was a DJ, and the feature album of the evening was Double Fantasy.
That's amazing.
And we had just played side one, turned it over to play side two, went to a PSA because it's a college radio station, KCOU, Columbia, Missouri, at the bottom of your FM radio dial, 88.1. And we had just, you have to do the FM radio DJ voice.
Oh, yes. So
we had just broken for the PSA when the AP alarm went off. It was a 5-bell alarm. I'd never heard that. You know, that was reserved for wars.
Yeah.
And it was that John had been shot.
Amazing.
Yeah. Wow. And then I played Beatle music all night, got ripped out of my mind and ended up passed out in the airport getting ready to go to New York. Yeah, that was a wild. Well, on that fine note, we'll take another break and we'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast. Again, that's at JATQ Podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. We're on a Beatle hangover right now with our friend John Fugelsang. He dropped his father moniker for the Beatle moniker in the last block. And John, I save this last block usually for something that you'd like to talk about that you haven't been able to. And so surprise me with what you think is important that we're missing today.
In politics, in the world?
Anywhere in the world. Oh, I leave it open to you.
that we're missing today.
Say what the world needs now is love, sweet love.
You need to listen to more Leonard Cohen. I'll say that. it's amazing with Joe Biden how I like him so much more now than I ever did at any point in my life.
Yep.
I don't agree with everything, but the guy he was on this campaign, the older, breathy, frail Joe Biden, who's not he was always kind of a prick, you know? I mean, even you watch the Anita Hill hearings. I mean, he was a prick the whole time. And sometimes that worked. He was a prick against apartheid. Go YouTube that clip of him talking to Secretary of State Schultz about our support for the apartheid regime. And you're like, oh, I want that guy to be president. But this gentle man that he has evolved into has the potential to be the most consequential president of our lifetime. But they have to get rid of the filibuster. They have to get rid of the filibuster because you can't do anything unless you get rid of this undemocratic, unconstitutional gimmick the founders never wanted. You know, the Constitution says the vice president will break a tie.
Yeah.
It says nothing about a 60 vote threshold. And I know the Republicans are going to do a lot of bad things when they get power again if there's no filibuster. But they're doing bad things now. They're going to do bad things no matter what.
And well, they're we can bad
stop
actors.
Them from doing bad things. And we can stop them from even winning more elections if we can pass some voting rights acts. Like every election, it all comes down to if there's high turnout, they'll lose. But they are not conservative. I don't know what conservatism means anymore in 2021. It seems to mean blind obedience to a racist reality show clown and owning the libs. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Owning the libs and blind obedience to, you know, fascism. I'll say this about Joe Biden. What surprised me about him, I find him to be more competent than and far more. There's a term that we used to use, presidential. He's far more presidential.
Yes.
And I like him more than I like some of his people. I think some of his people are far too concerned about protecting him when he is far more capable of being out there than even his people will admit. He proved that during the town hall meeting, but he's had very little interaction with the full press, the White House press corps. And that's because of his people. So I find that problematic.
Well, but ageism is the one acceptableism we have left, right? I mean, liberals do it. Liberals and conservatives both are so guilty of it. I mean, liberals did it to McCain. And, you know, I know 40-year-olds that don't have the energy McCain had.
Yes.
You know, with Bob Dole, it was more about his evil. But, you know, and I don't mind that Biden's old and he acts like an old guy. He's going up against, you know, much older Herbert Hoover economic ideas. So never forget that. The economic ideas he's against are a lot more decrepit than him.
Yeah, one of the things I really liked was when he came out and said, I'm against trickle down. And that's, I mean, 40 years of this crap and somebody finally called it.
That might be his legacy. Not that he was the end of Trump. He might be the end of Reaganism. And that might be his great legacy.
And that brings me right to the point. I think that he has the potential of going down as one of the better presidents of my lifetime, if not the best president of my lifetime, simply because he's faced what I consider the greatest evil in the United States in the last 40 years, and that's Reaganism. And I got so much crap from people. You know, I couldn't stand him from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And that was the first election I could vote in was 1980. And if I could have voted 10 times against Ronald Reagan, I would have.
You were right. And by the way, that myth has not held. Young people today aren't held in sway by the Reagan myth, and the middle-aged and old people aren't really leaning on Reagan as a saint anymore. I think you can look around and see how much his trickle-down economics actually helped the middle class. So, but I would still say, though, I still think that Bush, at least on paper, is still the worst president of my lifetime, but I don't know. I mean, you factor in the preventable deaths of COVID-19 of American citizens, and it could be Trump, but a million dead Iraqis for a lie. If all lives matter, then I don't see how Bush is not the worst president.
George W. Bush, I knew him when he was a governor in Texas. He's the one thing that, and see, you can't judge presidents by this because it's not fair to do it, but he was more personable.
I know he was.
one-on-one, you could sit and have a conversation with George Bush and you'd have a beer with him. You'd invite him to your backyard barbecue.
Everyone wanted to have a beer with the guy who only drinks O'Doul's. I know. I know how likable he was. I know. I'm just going by the policies, but the lies, the stuff. Yeah,
that, so on that alone, you may be right. But I think the jury is still out. And it was the harm, the indelible harm to the thin veneer of American, remarkableism that Donald Trump devastated, that's going to be hard pressed. I don't know what his influence, I think he is an influence for despots, fascists, and monarchies across the world. And I think that they will look at Donald Trump as he got away with this.
Well, yeah, and the worst part about it is that they'll look at him and say, oh, a dumb fascist got away with this much.
What happened?
Everyone wants to be the smart Trump. I mean, this guy in Florida thinks he's going to be the smart Trump. And in that sense, he's a very scary template. Yeah.
Well,
do you think he's going to run again, Brian? Do you think he'll run again?
Donald Trump?
Yeah.
Nope. I do not. I think it's a grift. I think I've said this. I've spent way too much time in his presence for me to believe anything that he says about anything.
Yeah.
I think he's all about himself. He's all about his money. And at the end, he'll go, you know, folks, this, I can almost hear it. You know, it's a witch hunt, but I'm going to do it for the betterment of our party. And DeSantis is my guy. I'm the kingmaker. He's my guy. And I could.
But I'm already hearing that he's already kind of angry that DeSantis is stealing his spotlight. I mean,
yes,
some people think that Trump is sending out Christine Noem to try to deflate DeSantis a bit. He's so petty
too.
Even if he doesn't want to be president, he would still turn on DeSantis because he doesn't have the game to.
Well, he will turn on. I could see him turning on anyone, and I picked DeSantis at random. Donald Trump will turn on and put anyone under the bus. I have no doubts about that. It's all about, and I think if he's worried about DeSantis, his real worry is not that he's stealing his thunder, but that he's stealing his money. And that's, you know, if DeSantis is doing much better at fundraising and cutting into the Donald's take, there's when you're going to really have a problem.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's right. All about the grift. I trust nothing out of this guy.
He's made $75 million this year in his PAC for Stop the Steal, and not a penny of that has gone towards any of these recount efforts. Well, he's just living off the money he's grifting from these fans. And that's what Trump University was. That's what Trump Foundation was. You know, everyone who trusts him, bondholder or an investor or a wife, everyone who trusts this guy finds out they were wrong.
Yeah, I put Michael Cohen's been on the show a couple of times.
And I just did his show last week, yeah.
Yeah, he is, first of all, he's funny. But secondly, man, when he talks about Donald Trump, it's like, wow. And he's a guy who knows. And my question to him was, what was the attraction? You're a smart guy. Why would you ever find yourself in this circle? He goes, Brian, it was just, you know, it was the ability to walk into a show and get, you know, in a front row seat. It was just the aura of that. And he goes, after a while, it came back. But he didn't realize it came back to bite him in his ass until he got bit in the ass.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Donald Trump will go down in history as one of the worst, if not the biggest grifter in American
politics. I completely agree. Agree.
So yeah. Final thoughts. If you're going to sit down and play an album, any Beatle album, which Beatle album would you put on first?
Revolver.
Ooh, nice.
It's their best album.
Oh God. You know, I've had fights with people over that.
Because you're mad that it's true. Revolver's their
I'm agreeing with you. I think Revolver is their best album.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
I think that
you hear every phase of the Beatles, every phase of the band is in one album. You hear Mop Tops and Psychedelia in one album.
And hard rock.
And hard rock, yeah. They invent hard rock. You hear George Harrison becoming a brilliant songwriter. You hear Paul McCartney's musicianship off the charts. I mean, you know, all three of them are writing at such a great peak on that record. And that's the one that bridges Rubber Soul to Pepper. I mean, it's like, that's where the whole thing blows up.
Well, and I love, I can't remember who did a cover of it, but I just love the Lennon composition, Turn Off Your Mind, Relax and Float Downstream.
I saw Wilco do that with Beck, Chibo Matto, and Sean Lennon on guitar and vocals, opening for Bob Dylan. I saw that.
Holy moly!
Yeah.
Have you ever listened to Phil Collins' version of that?
I have not.
That is a killer version of that song.
Okay. Tomorrow never. I never knew he did it. Okay.
Tomorrow never knows. Phil Collins' version of it is great.
I could talk Beatle covers all day. I'm such a geek. I could talk Beatle solo records all day. I could end a marriage with my Beatle crap. I'm telling you. But it's really. I never get to talk about this. It's so nice. Thank you.
All right. I'm a little older than you because I remember. Here's two of my earliest memories. Well, my earliest cogent memory of Lifetime was when John Kennedy was assassinated.
Wow.
And I was sitting in front of the TV set, and I remember it because my mother was crying. And I did not know why mom was crying, but I remember everyone's seen the shot now of Jackie walking off the airplane with blood stain on her dress. Well, we had a black and white TV and it looked like chocolate sauce to me. So I was going, mom's crying because that woman has a chocolate stain on her dress. I better not ever spill chocolate on my clothes. And that's how I remember Kennedy's assassination. But
what a memory.
That following February, I think it was February, when they were on the Ed Sullivan Show, my mom and dad let me stay up to watch the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Oh.
And there was I had never heard music like that before. I had never seen energy like that before. My dad was of the age, everyone was an Elvis fan and dad was a Buddy Holly fan. And dad became a Beatle fan because, and so I was a Beatle fan. And that was, and when their movies came out, we would go see them, Help and Hard Day's Night and Hard Day's Night and Help. And then, but my favorite was, I just like the ending of Yellow Submarine, the live action ending of Yellow Submarine.
Catchy tune, that.
Yeah. Blue Meanies. Blue Meanies have been sighted within the vicinity of this theater. How do we go out? Singing. 1, 2, 3. Ah! And then, off they go. And
that's my son's favorite movie. And he just played All Together Now for his virtual piano recital just last month.
When I was in high school, I did that song as a, for a, went out for rehearsal. And then, for a play that I was in, to audition for the play, we had to do a musical number, and I did All Together Now. That was right. 1, 2, 3, 4. Can I have a little more? But that's it meant something different, when you're an adult than when you were a kid. Well, listen, John, it's been a lot of fun, man. I hope we can have you back. We'll spend a whole lot of time. Anytime you want to talk Beatles, man, I'm in.
We covered politics and history and spirituality and a lot of music. It's really awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here. The show is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Ryan Karam. Thanks. We'll catch you next time.
Hey there, JATQ listeners. We deeply appreciate your listenership and the audience we've been able to cultivate while producing this podcast. Thanks to all of your support, we've been able to ramp things up and create even more content for you to enjoy. Through our Patreon page, there are lots of new and exciting things to check out. Due to the way Patreon is set up, it's entirely up to you, the listener, to decide what that content is worth. The podcast episodes will always be free, but if you want to gain access to our weekly newsletter, ad-free episodes, exclusive merch, and much, much more, you'll want to head over to patreon.com/JATQ podcast. That's patreon.com/JATQ podcast. Thanks. Have a great day.
Are you struggling to lower your bad LDL cholesterol, even though you may be taking a statin, swapping steaks for salads, and exercising while listening to this podcast? Ask your doctor if Repatha, evolocumab, is right for you.
With Repatha, you can dramatically reduce bad cholesterol and the risk of another heart attack while enjoying life too, because you're human. And with convenient self-administration, you can take Repatha in the comfort of your own home. Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Repatha can cause serious allergic reactions. Signs include trouble breathing or swallowing, or swelling of the face. Most common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. Visit Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA. Talk to your doctor today about Repatha.